Drive. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I rise first for introductions, if I may. It's Gregory Varello for the appellees. I'd like, with the court's permission, to introduce my colleague from the Florida Bar, Mr. Dennis Nowak of the Two Cardenas firm.
Welcome to Delaware.
Your Honor also knows my colleague, Lisa Brown. You may not know a newly admitted colleague of mine, Jeffrey Grivner. And I also would like to introduce, with the court's permission, two of my clients, Mr. Dornbusch, Mr. Schwartz, both visiting.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, John Harris on behalf of appellees John E. Abdo and BFC Financial Corporation. With me today is my co-counsel, Alan Fine.
Alan, welcome.
Mr. Fine will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Abdo and BFC Financial Corporation. And with the court's permission, I'd like to introduce my client, John E. Abdo.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Barr Flynn from Young Conaway for the appellant Benihana of Tokyo. Some brief introductions I have with me. Jonathan Rosenberg from the old O'Melveny Myers firm in New York. Sasha Lewis, also from O'Melveny and Myers. And Ms. Fran Mutamara Walker from my firm. Mr. Rosenberg and Ms. Lewis have been admitted pro hac, and Mr. Rosenberg will be, with the court's permission, making the presentation today.
All right.
May it please the court, we have asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Based on the undisputed facts in the record and the findings below, the transaction at issue was the product of a tainted negotiation process. Board member John Abdo, with full knowledge of the company's negotiating strategy for a convertible preferred issuance, negotiated against the company on behalf of BFC and obtained for BFC material terms that he was told in confidence the company would resist but concede if necessary. Not only did Abdo negotiate on inside information, but he negotiated without competition because he extracted from Benihana a no-shop commitment. And when the board approved this transaction, it was not told that Abdo had negotiated on BFC's behalf. It was not even shown that private placement memorandum from which Abdo negotiated, and it was not told that the changes that Abdo negotiated from the PPM were terms that he had been told in confidence that Benihana would concede if necessary. Because of this tainted process, the Court of Chancery erred in applying the business judgment rule. But the Court of Chancery also committed error in failing to apprehend the undisputed facts showing why this tainted process was allowed to occur. Those facts show that the objective of the process was not to find the best terms for raising capital for Benihana, but rather to raise capital in a way that diluted BOT's control. What are those undisputed facts? I just want to touch briefly on four. First, Benihana senior management was concerned about BOT's control power in late 2003, and in August 2003 explored ways of diluting that control power. This was a finding of the court below. Second, senior management hired the investment bank Morgan Joseph in October 2003, and as its very first project, senior management had Morgan Joseph analyze the cost, calculate the cost of buying out BOT's control stock, and explore the company's options for dealing with BOT's control. Third, just 2 months later, Morgan Joseph and Benihana management recommend issuing $20 million in convertible preferred stock with immediate as if converted voting rights, even though Benihana had strong cash flow, was conservatively leveraged as measured by its total debt over EBITDA, had many, quote, highly feasible debt options, in the word of Fred Joseph, and was projected to be even more conservatively leveraged over the term of the renovation plan, even if it financed the entire cost of it entirely with debt rather than equity. And fourth, After the dilution that BOT suffered in the first $10 million tranche takedown from 50.9% voting power to 42.5% voting power did not prevent BOT from winning a proxy contest in the fall of 2004, Benihana management drew down the second $10 million tranche in August 2005, 2 years before it had to under the contract. And when Benihana's already conservative leverage was a minuscule 0.15, meaning that Benihana's cash flow in 1 year could pay down its total debt six times over. And at that point, that further diluted BOT's voting power from 42.5% to 36.5%. And what of the timing? It was just immediately before the shareholder meeting in the fall of 2005 and a director election at which Messrs. Dornbush and Yoshimoto would be up for re-election. The failure of the Court of Chancery to understand the import of these undisputed facts led it to reversible error. Now, I first want to focus in a little bit more detail on the tainted negotiation process. Morgan Joseph's January 2004 board book at page A481 told the board that the terms of convertible preferred issuances vary widely and are, quote, heavily negotiated. The court found that John Abdo attended the February 17th board meeting, during which Morgan Joseph discussed with the board the terms on which it anticipated having to make concessions during the upcoming negotiations. Thus, Abdo was privy to the company's negotiating strategy for a transaction that was supposed to be heavily negotiated. What did Abdo negotiate from? Well, he negotiated from the PPM that Morgan Joseph prepared and issued in early April of 2004, which Abdo testified was, quote, in his words, fair to both sides. Yet after obtaining the company's commitment not to shop this PPM to any other investor, Abdo negotiated the following four changes for BFC. First, even though the PPM provided for the company's option on the second $10 million tranche, Abdo, knowing from the February 17th board meeting that the company would concede if necessary on that, negotiated a mandatory second tranche on the $10 million. Second, even though the PPM provided for a minimum of 5 years between the two tranches, Abdo, knowing that if necessary, the company would concede the tranches altogether and would agree to do $20 million all at once, lowered it from a minimum of 1 year between the two tranches to a maximum of 3 years. Even though the private placement memorandum provided for a perpetual maturity, Abdo, knowing from the February 17th board meeting that the company would agree to a 5 to 10 year maturity, negotiated a 10-year maturity for BFC. And even though the private placement memorandum provided for no preemptive rights, Abdo, knowing that the company would concede on that from the February 17th board meeting, negotiated for preemptive rights. Now, critically, Benihana CEO Joel Schwartz conceded at trial that all of these changes were materially adverse to Benihana. But the court missed these critical facts, and how do we know that? We know it by comparing page 23 of the court's opinion to page 18 of the court's opinion. On page 23, the court lists the terms that Abdo negotiated for, and the court included among those terms a mandatory second tranche and preemptive rights. On page 18, the court listed the areas on which Morgan Joseph told the board on February 17th that the company might have to make concessions. But when the court listed those on page 18, it left out the mandatory second tranche and the preemptive rights. But Joseph testified at trial that those were two areas he told the board on February 17th he might have to concede in negotiations. Indeed, the mandatory second tranche was the subject of dramatic testimony that we cited in our briefs, in which Joseph said, because of Abdo's participation in the February 17th meeting, all he could do was fake, insisting on an optional second tranche takedown. How else do we know that the court missed the significance of Abdo's negotiating advantage? By virtue of the court's analysis of Abdo negotiating the 10-year maturity from the perpetual maturity in the PPM, On page 23, footnote 78, the court states, quote, this result was consistent with Morgan Joseph's prediction that it would be difficult for Benihana to get a perpetual maturity in the issuance. Well, it would have been a prediction if Morgan Joseph was negotiating against an unrelated arm's-length third party. But since he was negotiating against Abdo, who had been at the February 17th meeting, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Section 144A1 could not apply because the board did not know all the material facts regarding the transaction. And what does materiality mean? It means facts that are relevant and of a magnitude to be important to directors in carrying out their fiduciary duty of care in decision making. In the insider transaction context, duty of care requires that the directors investigate whether the insider has gotten an unfair negotiating advantage. Therefore, it was insufficient for the court to rely on Joseph's view that Benihana, quote, ended up where we wanted to be, which is what the court relied on page 56. Rather, in the Section 144 materiality context, the question was whether the board knew of the negotiating advantage that Abdo had and how he used that advantage in a way that no arm's-length third party could have done. But even if this court finds that Section 144A1 does not require that the board have this information, the business judgment rule still should not have applied because Abdo breached his fiduciary duty of loyalty. What is the conduct constituting that breach? Basically five things. He negotiated for BFC from the PPM with full knowledge on the terms on which Benihana anticipated having to make concessions. He extracted from Benihana terms he was told on February 17th that the company would resist conceding, but would concede if necessary. He did so even though he viewed the PPM terms as fair to both sides. He did so knowing he had no competition because he made the company agree to a no-shop commitment. And fifth, he never disclosed to the Benihana board his conduct, even though he appeared in front of them on May 6th, the day they met to approve this transaction. I want to focus on why we believe that the Court of Chancery also committed reversible error in its finding that there was no primary purpose to dilute. And we've argued in our brief that the court essentially made a legal error and abused its discretion on the facts. What's the legal error? The court found that Schwartz had a demonstrated interest in diluting BOT. That's because he was concerned in late 2003 about BOT's voting control, and he explored ways of eliminating it, including by issuing 16.5 million Class A shares. Once the court found that Schwartz had a purpose to dilute at the time this transaction was under consideration, it was legal error to conclude that that dilutive purpose was not the primary purpose of this transaction. The law, as the court recognized on page 65 of its decision, is that if there's both a legitimate and an illegitimate purpose, like a dilutive purpose, that motivated transaction, it would be a mockery to deem the illegitimate purpose, the dilutive purpose, merely incidental. Well, it is just that mockery that occurred when the court held on page 70 that Schwartz's dilutive purpose did not, quote, infect his decision-making regarding this dilutive transaction. Thus, the court committed legal error in failing to find that Schwartz's dilutive objective was the primary purpose of this transaction. But even if the court below did not find that dilution was one of the purposes motivating Schwartz in this particular transaction, the court below still abused its discretion. And how did that happen? Because the court did not understand the dual purposes that senior management had in hiring Morgan Joseph in October of 2003. What does the court say about the purpose of Morgan Joseph's hiring? It says on page 15 of its opinion, quote, Benihana retained the investment banking firm Morgan Joseph to determine what other financial options the company might use to carry out its five-year construction and renovation program, close quote. But the evidentiary record is clear that finding funding sources was not the only reason that Morgan Joseph was hired. There was a second reason, and that was dealing with BOT's voting control. The very first presentation that Morgan Joseph made in early November 2003 was in calculating the cost of buying out BOT's voting control. And that's a book that's at A206 of our appendix. And then on November 10th, 2003, Morgan Joseph met with Benihana Management to discuss not only the renovation plan, but the BOT situation. And the agenda for that meeting is at C203 of our appendix. And I want to quote from that agenda the portion that deals with BOT. It says, quote, discuss potential sale of control interest. Issues with the trust, meaning BOT. Trust long-term and short-term goals and desires. Impact on operations. Impact on board. Company options for dealing with the potential sale, i.e. of the control interest. Purchasing for cash, exchanging for other securities, diffuse ownership. The court never mentioned these November 2003 discussions between management and Morgan Joseph in its 79-page opinion. Thus, the court could not appreciate the link between the October 2003 hiring of Morgan Joseph and Morgan Joseph's recommendation to the board in January of 2004 that it issue preferred stock with immediate as-if-converted voting rights. In fact, the court mistakenly found on page 23 of its opinion that it was BFC that negotiated for immediate as-if-converted voting rights. Abdo didn't need to negotiate for that because it was a fundamental component of Morgan Joseph's recommendation right from day one, and it was part of the PPM that there would be immediate as-if-converted voting rights. And yet, Mr. Joseph, when he testified at trial, could not recall focusing on or having done any work on whether a company in financial circumstances similar to Benihana had ever issued preferred stock with as-if-converted voting rights.
You indicated you wanted to say 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I do.
It's up to you. You do eat whatever you like.
I do, Your Honor. I think the only other thing I'll mention is on the primary purpose analysis, what the court also overlooked is one of the written rationale that Morgan Joseph provided on the convertible preferred issuance in January 2004. And that is getting Benihana a, quote, new investor class and balance for its concentrated ownership structure. Of course, the flip side of this balance is that BOT would get diluted. Now, we've also argued in our briefs that if the court upholds the primary purpose analysis, that there should be a modified UNICAL test, and we've described why we believe that the entire fairness test should apply. But at this point, I'll rely on the briefs and ask the court that it reverse the judgment of the Chancery, of the Court of Chancery, and remand for further proceedings on the issue of the appropriate remedy.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Gregory Gorello for all appellees other than BFC Financial and John Abdo. Today I will address issues common to all defendants, and Mr. Fine will take 5 minutes of the time allotted in this argument to address issues peculiar to his client, Mr. Abdo and BFC. As we see them, Your Honors, the issues for decision today are as follows. First, are the trial court's findings relating to the board's exercise of due care on this record supported by the evidence and consistent with an orderly and logical reasoning process? Second, are the court's findings, which are based on live witness credibility determinations, that the sole or primary purpose of the board was not entrenchment, entitled to deference? Third, should the court extend UNICAL to adopt a new standard of review? Fourth, did the court below improperly interpret the Benihana Certificate of Incorporation? And finally, are the trial court's findings that Director Abdo did not breach his duty of loyalty, again based on specific credibility determinations entitled to deference?
Mr. Varallo,
yes, Your Honor.
Should I take it from your outline of the points that you believe that the issue about extending UNICAL was fairly presented to the Vice Chancellor?
No, Your Honor, you should not. But rather than quibble with my friend about whether Rule 8 should bar that issue, I am prepared to address it on the merits. Should your honors believe that it wasn't fairly presented, we're perfectly happy that you don't address it. The fact of the matter is the case that my friend cites, which is called Gregory against Correction Connection in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, was never cited to the Vice Chancellor or argued to the Vice Chancellor. This case was a sole or primary purpose of entrenchment case. That's how it was tried, and that's how it was decided. Nobody argued UNICAL below. Your Honor, a bit of background, if I may. This is a case about the decision of a board made up of a majority of conceitedly disinterested and independent directors to finance a five-year renovation plan that even BOT trustees agree was necessary for this company. And that decision was made to finance with a mixture of debt and equity and not solely debt. That's the case in a nutshell. Before I launch into my argument, I think it's important to call a few factors to the court's attention. At the beginning, I think it's critical for the court to understand that my friends have conceded on this record that they are not challenging the court below's findings relating to the independence and disinterest of a majority of the board. That's at page 1, footnote 2 to their reply brief. Second, I think the court is probably aware, but I'm going to draw it to your attention anyway, there are a number of express credibility determinations made in the opinion based upon live witness testimony. This is important, of course, because just last week this court reaffirmed en banc that its standard of review with respect to live witness credibility determinations was that they would be upheld, quote-unquote, from the Disney opinion. The trial court found that Kevin Aoki, one of the appellant BOT's trustees, was not credible. It's an express finding at page 12 of the opinion. The trial court also expressly found that the testimony of witnesses Abdo, Joseph, and Dornbush was each credible, and those findings are at pages 12, 60, and 67 of the opinion below. Finally, the trial court made credibility determinations that exonerate Director Schwartz, who also testified live at trial. Those findings are at pages 61 and 70 of the court's opinion. If I can turn briefly to the due care record at trial, the record showed careful deliberation over how to proceed by this conceitedly disinterested and independent board over no fewer than five separate board meetings. Those meetings were January 20, February 17, May 6, May 20, and June 11 of 2004. Five separate board meetings. The board had an outside investment banker present at each of these meetings, and the board also retained a consulting engineering expert in the restaurant industry, WD Partners, to attend several of its meetings and to give it advice concerning its renovation program. The investment banker walked through options available to finance this renovation program with the board. The investment banker considered and reported to the board and discussed getting bank debt, getting high-yield debt, doing equity or doing a sale-leaseback type transaction. In addition, between the first and second meetings, those in January and February, and between the second and third and fourth meetings, the directors were encouraged to bring home their materials and study before they took final action, and they, in fact, did so. The outside investment banker recommended that the board pursue an equity issuance. And the logic for doing so in this particular case was compelling. The company continued to be conservatively leveraged. This was a matter of great concern to the directors, almost all of whom were veteran insiders in the restaurant industry. Mr. Pine, for example, who ran publicly held restaurant associates for some number of years, testified at trial that he had seen a situation where restaurant associates had taken on too much debt, lost its leverage, lost its ability to quickly respond to changing market conditions, and wound up in grave financial distress. This was a group of business executives who had lived through exactly this kind of decision before. So not only did they continue to be conservatively leveraged, issuing equity rather than debt gave the company more flexibility in dealing with its banks, and it matched long-term financing with a long-term capital need. Finally, it avoided very onerous performance covenants that the record shows would have come with the debt, and provided flexibility for for this board of directors to take care of potential acquisition opportunities as they arose in the future. Moreover, these directors made a conscious decision to take less leverage rather than more. My friends fault that decision, but this was a decision of the board of directors convened with many, many years of inside experience. The board then sought out and received a fairness opinion before finally approving the transaction. Thereafter, when BOT counsel, the appellant's counsel, produced a number of purported alternative offers, what did the company do? First, it convened an ad hoc committee of independent directors to consider the first of those offers. It sent each of the offers to its outside investment bank for analysis and advice, and then it convened as a board to accept the recommendation of the ad hoc committee and the investment banker, and decided after hearing those presentations not to go forward with the alternatives. Your Honors, this is a case far closer to the best practices that Justice Jacobs wrote about for this court in Disney than merely satisfying due care. After a four-day-long trial, the trial judge carefully and methodically considered the totality of the record before him, explicitly weighed and made findings of credibility with respect to the live witnesses who testified before him, and issued a carefully reasoned and thorough 80-page post-trial opinion, an 80-page opinion, just full of challenges, full of findings. Let me move, if I can, to my friend's challenge to the safe harbor. Under 144A1, the issue framed by the court below was whether the board knew or had sufficient information concerning the material facts concerning the transaction to fit within 144A1. My friend basically attacks on 144A1 and says that finding, that holding was incorrect because the board did not know that Mr. Abdo was involved in the negotiations. Your Honors, the trial court correctly concluded, based on the testimony presented, that prior to the May 6th board meeting — now, May 6th is the meeting at which the BFC transaction is presented after it was negotiated with Mr. Abdo — that prior to that meeting, Mr. Schwartz did, in fact, tell Messrs. Becker, Sturgis, and Sano, and possibly Mr. Pine, in one-on-one conversations of Abdo's role. That's in the record. Probably the easiest place to find it is at A53 at pages 89 and 90. Moreover, the trial testimony fully supports that finding. That's Mr. Schwartz's testimony at trial. But perhaps more to the point, the May 6 board book that Morgan Joseph, the banker, prepared and presented to the board said in its first point, under a heading called Introduction, that, quote, Morgan Joseph was approached by John Abdo, BFC Financial Corporation's vice chairman and a member of Benihana's board of directors, indicating that BFC would be interested in investing in the company on terms comparable to those contemplated, close quote. And that's at A446, should you want to look at it. Likewise, Your Honors, every director knew that Abdo was only one of two principals of BFC, and Mr. Abdo himself made the presentation on behalf of BFC at the board meeting before recusing himself so the board could discuss and act. Mr. Pine, the director who may not have been told in advance of Mr. Abdo's personal role as a negotiator, testified that it wouldn't have made a difference to him because he knew that Abdo would be one of the ultimate decision makers. That's at A135, 994, and 95. Let me turn, if I may, briefly to substantive due care. First of all, my friends raised three challenges in the briefs. Those challenges are, one, whether the board knew who negotiated. That, I think, merges with 144A1 for purposes of this particular case, so I won't repeat myself. Two, whether the board knew about certain changes to the term sheet. And three, whether the board knew correct net debt figures. As for changes to the term sheet, it's a red herring. The board got the term sheet on or about April 30. It's in the record. It's undisputed. When the board convened on May 6, it had the term sheet. Could have compared it to the earlier term sheet if it wanted to. There is testimony in the record that the board also discussed specific changes between the earlier term sheet, the so-called wish list of January, February, and the April 30 term sheet. That testimony is found at B27, 919, and 20. Third, the court credited live testimony that the directors understood and expected there to be changes in the term sheet, and indeed there were some changes. And finally, the court made an express credibility finding with respect to the testimony of Mr. Joseph, the banker, at page 60 of the opinion, that Joseph honestly believed that the changes that were made were not significant and that he did not mislead the board. With respect to net debt figures, it is true that there were incorrect net debt figures in the January and February meetings. Again, however, a red herring, because by the May 6th meeting, those net debt figures were corrected. And not only were they corrected, Your Honors, but the banker called the correction to the board's attention. Banker's testimony, as he said to the board, these were an error, they've been fixed, it doesn't change my recommendation. Let me move briefly to solar primary purpose. It's been in our law a very long time, tracks back probably to the Schnell versus Chriscraft test. My friends argue that in the face of a concession of an independent majority of the board and in the face of express credibility determinations, that somehow there still ought to have been a finding of solar primary purpose. In the court below and in the briefing, my friends focus on two separate directors. They focus on Mr. Dornbusch and Mr. Schwartz with respect to the alleged solar primary purpose to entrench. With respect to Dornbusch, the court reviewed the evidence, held that he was at the time 75 years old, then not an equity partner in his law firm, not a profit-sharing partner in his law firm, and that he did not act with the solar primary purpose of entrenchment. The court further stated that it expressly found him, a live witness testifying at trial, to be credible. So the court made its solar primary purpose determination with respect to defendant Dornbusch based upon a credibility finding. With respect to Mr. Schwartz, it is not correct, as Mr. Rosenberg said, that the court had concluded that Mr. Schwartz had a purpose to dilute. Mr. Schwartz was, by the court, found to have been concerned in 2003 about control of a BOT. Mr. Schwartz at the time was 63 years old, and as the court found below, he had a 5-year non-cancelable employment contract taking him through age 68 or 2009. That's at page 8, footnote 20 of the opinion. The court also found there was no special relationship between Schwartz and BFC, the buyer of this equity, and that BFC would expect Schwartz to perform just like any other manager, hold Mr. Schwartz to the same level of accountability as any other shareholder. The court reviewed in detail the evidence that my friends brought before it, that Mr. Schwartz had considered the effect of stock dividends or stock issuances on the continued special voting rights of BOT, and found that this evidence tended to show Mr. Schwartz was concerned. But in light of Schwartz's testimony at trial and the totality of the evidence, the court also made a finding. And the court's finding at page 70 is as follows with respect to Mr. Schwartz. Quote, Schwartz's concern did not infect his own or the board's decision-making process in connection with the BFC transaction. Close quote. Finally, the court found that even if it was wrong about Mr. Schwartz's subjective motivation, since a majority of conceitedly disinterested directors voted to approve the transaction, and their assent was not the result of fraud or manipulation, a finding the court expressly makes, the transaction would still stand. That's old law, Your Honors. That's Puma versus Marriott, and that's the CD case that we cited as well. Let me, if I may, move briefly to
Mr.
try to...
Burrell, I'm, yes, afraid, sir? I'm afraid you're out of time.
I will sit down then, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm here to discuss the breach of fiduciary duty issues raised by BOT vis-a-vis Mr. Abdo. I found the briefing on this issue rather remarkable in that, as we pointed out in our briefs, the breach of fiduciary duties raised in post-trial are very, very much different than those actually tried. Basically, they break down into two themes, as I understand them. The first is that Mr. Abdo misused confidential information, in the negotiations. And the second theme is that Mr. Abdo didn't tell the board that he was involved in the negotiations. Mr. Borallo hit on some of the facts showing that, as to that second argument, the board was well aware of Mr. Abdo's role in the negotiations. The overriding theme at trial as to these charges was that Mr. Abdo was always focused on acquiring BOT's stock through Kevin Aoki. And on those points, on those central themes, the court made specific findings that Mr. Aoki was, quote, not credible, unreliable, and that Mr. Abdo was credible and convincing. Nevertheless, BOT trudges on, and I want to examine each argument. With regard to the issue of the misuse of confidential information, we've heard counsel talk about that today. The first question is, what do they consider to be confidential information? And in their brief, they tell us, in their reply brief at 2 and 3, counsel argues, or Kevin Aoki was told, that everything said in the boardroom is confidential. Of course, that can't be what confidential information is, because at a board meeting, public information is discussed, common sense and common market knowledge is discussed. It's got to mean something else. So what, in terms of this appeal, does BOT consider to be confidential information that Mr. Abdo misused? Well, we know what it's not. We know that it had nothing to do with any information regarding what Mr. Joseph and every other witness considered to be the key negotiating points of the transaction. And those points include things like price, the coupon rate, and the number of board seats that the purchaser would be getting. And the reason counsel doesn't argue about that is that they were all negotiated in Benihana's favor. Mr. Joseph testified, and the court thought this was so important that he actually quoted it twice. He said, "You've got to remember what's important. On important points, we ended up where we wanted to be." And in that regard, the court referred to Mr. Joseph's beliefs as credible, honest, and sincere. So what are we talking about in this appeal? We're not talking about the key negotiating points or whether or not the ultimate deal that was negotiated was fair. Rather, we talk about three points: the mandatory second tranche, and you can find these, they've been called 5 points, 3 points, 2 points. I think at pages 18 and 21 of the original brief, BOT identifies three: the mandatory second tranche, preemptive rights, and perpetual maturity. As to the first, it goes back to what is confidential, mandatory second tranche. If a board director says, gee, I think we ought to get 1,000 times earnings, and the investment banker says, well, you're not going to get that. You're not going to get that. Saying you're not going to get that is not dramatic testimony, as counsel suggested it was today. It is market reality. It is what people in the marketplace know. Mr. Abdo testified that he didn't need Mr. Joseph or anyone else to tell him that no one was going to agree to a transaction in which Benihana had the choice as to whether it was a $10 million transaction or a $20 million transaction to be decided sometime in the future. So that certainly was not confidential information. Preemptive rights. With regard to that, as we pointed out in our brief, there's no record that was even discussed at the February 17th meeting. And when you look at the court's listing of what was discussed at page 18, it's not there. And with regard to perpetual maturity, the court noted that Mr. Joseph found, as the market realized, that it was far more typical to find a 5 to 10 year play in that. But nevertheless, was able to negotiate a situation where Benihana could pay back in stock, which made it effectively perpetual in any event.
Thank you, Mr. Pond.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honors, I have about 3.5 minutes. Counsel makes the point that the primary purpose finding is based on the credibility of live witness testimony. But in Packer versus Yamble, then Vice Chancellor Jacobs found that even if there was no subjective intent to dilute, that based on the objective facts of the non-dilutive means that the board did not explore, that a primary intent to dilute could be inferred. So it's not just based on live witnesses. It's based on the totality of the circumstances, and that's what all of the primary purpose cases do. And one other thing, Schwartz never testified. There is no testimony from Schwartz in the record that he didn't have a dilutive purpose at the time of this transaction. counsel talks about how Benihana wanted to keep its leverage down and how it wanted financial flexibility. Well, the testimony is, again, that the company would still have been conservatively leveraged even if it had its cake and ate it too. It did all of its renovations, and it did all of it through debt, and it got everything that it needed. It still would have been conservatively leveraged at the end of 2007. It wanted financial flexibility. Joseph testified that even if it did the company did this entire transaction through debt, it would still have financial flexibility at the end of 2007. Indeed, if it, under the company's own projections, it still would have had $26.8 million left for acquisitions, which was one of the things that Mr. Joseph said that the board should be able to do or should have the flexibility to do. $26.8 million, the only acquisitions that the company had done previously were from between $8 to $12 million, and even without that $26.8 million, if it needed to acquire companies that themselves would provide EBITDA for the company, it could have issued more equity and found other funding sources. The board did not know that Abdo negotiated on BFC's behalf, and it did not know the changes that he negotiated from the PPM. The court found that the board did not know. The court found that even though that board member Pine asked, the board did not know. And all the testimony that appellees cite, it just stands for the proposition that the board knew that somehow he was involved. And in fact, all the court said is that the board knew that presumably Abdo was the ultimate decision maker. Presumably. The ultimate decision maker could have been somebody who stood back, withdrew from the process, recused himself, just like he did on May 6th, and let Alan Levan, his partner in BFC, negotiate the terms of the deal. And then at the end, when Levan came back to him with a deal, negotiated at arm's length from an independent third party who didn't have access to confidential terms on February 17th, then Abdo could have said yay or nay. And that would have been fully consistent with his fiduciary duties, and the board would have had all the material information under those circumstances. I believe my time is up. I will sit down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.